From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on July 5th, 2012. 17 Magazine, which aims squarely at young girls, made a public pledge. The magazine's editors announced that they would stop airbrushing images of women in their magazine. That promise came after an eighth grade girl led a national campaign to shame the magazine following some rather obvious and unfortunate photoshopping efforts. When 17 fessed up and promised to stop, it generated national headlines. After all, many magazines did and still do Photoshop the female models. Body image remains a hot subject of debate. In Rochester, Feminists for Nonviolent Choices is an organization that focuses on many issues, and this month they're hosting a number of events with one theme. They're looking at the sexualization of children, especially young girls. Their featured speaker is an internationally known journalist and social commentator from Australia named Melinda Tankard-Reist. Reist had become a force in the effort to stop the exploitation of children, and she has led movements aimed at changing laws in Australia and around the world. Now, Reist was going to be in Rochester this week, but for a number of reasons, she's still in Australia. She will lead a discussion of her books on Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m. at Writers and Books in Rochester. She'll do that via Skype. Now, Reist has helped she's helped edit Getting Real, The Sexualization of Young Girls, and Big Porn, Inc., exposing the harms of the global pornography industry. Last night, thanks to the weather, the Little Theater had to cancel a screening of the documentary titled Sexy Baby, and it's all about this issue. But they will, at the Little, show Sexy Baby in just a few weeks, April 2nd, 6:15 p.m. April 2nd, 6:15 p.m. for a screening of the documentary, including a discussion after the showing. This hour, we'd like to hear from you. How can parents help stop the sexualization of children? Is it a concern for you? Are young girls pressured to look like adults too soon? We will share your phone calls and comments later in the hour. But first, we want to bring you my interview with Melinda Tankard-Reist. It was recorded this morning, so again, we're going to listen to this, and then in our second half hour, we'll hear from some other voices, including you. First of all, as a little bit of background about your career, I'm curious to know about the term pro-life feminism. And when you were emerging on the scene, did you find it odd that you would run into people who perhaps didn't think that being pro-life and being a feminist could go together?
Oh, yes, all the time. I still do. In fact, it was through the organization that was going to be hosting me in the U.S. That I originally found pro-life feminism. I was studying journalism in California in the 1980s, in fact, and at Cal State Long Beach, and discovered pro-life feminism there and felt that I'd found a home. I didn't know there was such a thing, and it resonated with me because I felt that, you know, you couldn't really call yourself pro-life unless you were addressing the real needs of women, and that the needs of women and their babies were actually intertwined. If you harmed one, you harmed the other. And I suppose the pro-life feminist theory made a big impact on me, that we needed to address the structural conditions that often compelled women to have terminations, when really they were often having unwanted abortions. And I felt that we needed to address those needs, and that was really the only true pro-life action to take. So I set up a couple of housing services for women on my return, and basically introduced the pro-life feminism that I found in America to Australia.
When you speak to pro-choice feminists, do you? I'm sure the conversations can run the gamut from heated and emotional to rational. Do you think you've changed some minds?
Look. I suppose what I've tried to do is take some of the heated polemic out of the debate, because I don't feel that really serves the real needs of women. I've tried to find common ground where I can. I mean, I'm involved in movements in Australia and globally which are very diverse. My work on prostitution, pornography, trafficking, objectification, sexualization, violence against women has brought a lot of people together for a common cause. And so I've tried to, I suppose, go beyond the heated divides and the usual debates, because I don't think they serve us. And I think we should all agree that women shouldn't be coerced into abortions they'd rather not have. They shouldn't have to have abortions because they're going to get kicked out of school, or they're not going to have their educational needs met, or their employer won't provide for them and their child. So I try to find common ground where I can. And I feel like that's the only way we'll achieve anything to address the real needs, the real unmet needs of women.
We're talking to Melinda Tankard-Reist, who is an Australian journalist, author, and social commentator, who is a featured speaker for a number of events coming up in Rochester. Feminists for Nonviolent Choices are focusing on the subject this year, challenging the sexualization of girls, and that's exactly the title of Melinda's one of the books she helped author and edit, Getting Real, Challenging the Sexualization of Girls, and Big Porn, Inc., Exposing the Harms of the Global Pornography Industry. So as we look at this subject, Melinda, you've described it as a kind of disease, the pornification of the culture, of little girls, little girls feeling like they have to feel hot or sexy at almost appallingly young ages, children being pressured to look and act much older than they are. And in advance of your appearance on our show, we've heard from parents who feel very strongly about this, even if they haven't been able to articulate it. What have you heard from parents about the books that you have put together and about this subject in general?
Well, look, this is a global concern, and I'm not surprised at all that you're hearing from parents sharing those concerns. Our children are growing up in a shadow cast by pornography. Our girls are being raised to believe that they have to be thin, hot, and sexy, that they exist primarily to attract male attention, to be on display, that it is in bearing their flesh that they demonstrate that they are women. Boys are being raised with a sense of entitlement to the bodies of women and girls. My book, Getting Real, Challenging the Sexualization of Girls, is a record bestseller for my publisher, Spinifex Press, which I think shows that this has struck a chord. I mean, I cannot keep up with the requests for me to address parents, schools, medical bodies, teaching organizations around the country, because the impacts on our young people are so great. We know that when we sexualize girls, we contribute to body image dissatisfaction, anxiety, depression, eating disorders, self-harm. In Australia, self-harming rates in girls have increased 90% in only 10 years. Deliberate self-harm, that's the phenomenon of cutting, where girls are cutting their bodies. We have 1 in 100 girls anorexic, 1 in 10 bulimic. And also on the issue of pornography, our children are acting out what they're seeing in porn. We have rising rates of child-on-child sexual assault around the world. And so, parents contact me all the time saying, what can we do about this? And, there's a global movement against it now. For example, Brave Girls Want Change, which started in America, is a global movement now to address this issue.
And this is, I think, the most important part of the discussion, in that, number one, you help parents identify the problem and articulate the problem, but it is more difficult to identify solutions. Kids, when it comes to what the kids feel and what parents feel like they can do, some parents have told us they don't know where to start. What do you tell them, and what are we seeing globally that has shown to have an impact on this?
Well, that's one of the reasons that I was a co-founder in Australia of a grassroots campaigning movement called Collective Shout for a World Free of Sexploitation. And what we do is we empower and equip people to take action personally and to take action politically. So I advise parents, don't buy into the culture. Someone's fueling the demand for the padded bras for children, for the sexualized slogans on underwear, for the inappropriate toys and games aimed at our children. So we don't fuel the demand. We opt out of the culture that does that. We boycott the companies that don't offer appropriate clothing, a diversity of choice, which limit and stereotype and narrow our girls. And we also encourage parents to act politically. We need change at the political level. We need a regulation. The advertising industry, the marketers, the big corporations have got away with this behavior for too long. But they're making money off the backs of our children, off our young people who are paying the biggest price. So we have been leading in Australia and globally actions against big corporations to remove inappropriate products, to not screen violent videos to take down billboards depicting and celebrating and glamorizing violence against women, as a few examples. So people have to rise up. People have to demand change, demand action. You know, our political leaders won't change unless they know there's a constituency for change, unless they're forced to change. So that's some of the advice that we give.
And there are two prongs to that, and I want to touch on both of those separately, starting with the fact that if our listeners are not aware, Melinda has helped lead awareness campaigns in Australia that, for example, pushed the government to ban certain computer games. And you talk about the politically getting more involved or asking the government to do more. But when you're speaking broadly about regulation, are there specific changes, you know, whether it's in the United States or globally, et cetera, are there specific changes that government can make in short order that would make an impact?
Sure. Well, I wanted to just touch on that game that you mentioned. That was a game called Rape Play, which is a rape simulation game in which boys are taught how to rape a mother and her two daughters who are aged 8 and 10. These rape simulation games are very popular. They come from Japan, where a quarter of all rapists are under the age of 19, a third of all victims are under the age of 19, and half of those are in primary school. And when I discovered that these games were being played in Australia, I made a complaint to our Communication and Media Authority, and I got those games banned. But, you know, we are the only country in the world to ban them. They're still being played in the US. They're still being played in other parts of the world. In fact, campaigners in the US who have tried to stop those games have had death threats. Some have had to move house, change addresses. Again, this is where we need government to step in. And one of the big problems in the US is this this idea that free speech means anything, you know. So-called freedom of speech really often exists to protect the perpetrators of harm. We don't think that free speech should mean hate speech or speech that promotes violence against women and children, which is a global epidemic. Another problem we have with our governments globally is often they are beholden to vested interests, beholden to big business. You know, these businesses buy power. The porn industry, the sex industry, is worth $100 billion US a year. $100 billion US a year. So, you know, we're up against really powerful forces here. And, you know, it's a hard battle. But surely governments that genuinely care about the common good, that care about their people, should recognize this harm. Now, the UK is doing that, and we should be following Britain's lead. For example, Britain has cracked down on retailers. It's cracked down on the music industry. And it has introduced an opt-in system for pornography. So it's not taking pornography away. What it's saying is, if you want porn, you have to contact your ISP provider and specifically request it. It won't automatically come on your computer, because we know the average age of first exposure to pornography is 11. And our kids are seeing torture porn, sadism porn, rape porn, incest porn, bestiality at that age and even younger. So we are advocating, certainly here in Australia, that we follow the UK's lead and crack down on some of these very harmful industries. We don't believe that their money should inoculate them or protect them from accountability and transparency and scrutiny and regulation.
Cynics might say that if you try to ban computer games or online imagery, that there are ways to circumvent it and that it wouldn't work anyway. What do you say to that?
Well, this is just an automatic argument. We hear it all the time, and we hear it from the people that stand most to profit, that stand most to gain from it. Britain clearly thinks there's a way forward because they're doing it. It's the rest of us that are being left behind. You know, it's those with vested interests, those that want to keep pornography free and accessible and all over the internet. Why should the internet be the Wild West? You know, we don't allow stuff that appears there to be shown on TV, to appear in the movies, to be shown on our newsstands. Why can a child with a press of a button see a woman being tortured, being raped, being sodomized? Can't we agree that at least we should be protecting children from this content? We have a growing body of literature, again, particularly out of the UK, testifying to the harms of exposing children to pornography. We are engaging in an unprecedented experiment on the healthy sexual development of our children and young people. Our boys are being conditioned and molded in their sexuality in very unhealthy ways, and they're seeing girls as just service stations to meet their needs. So look, we can't just throw our hands up and give up. Let's have a look at what the UK is doing and at least give that a try.
We're talking to Melinda Tankard-Reist, who is certainly started as a journalist and became a social commentator and author and editor of books and one of the leading global voices in the effort to stop sex trafficking, sexualization of children, among many other things. And I read an article online that it's pretty easy to find if you Google "Who's Afraid of Melinda Tankard-Reist." I assume you've seen it, Melinda.
I don't Google my name. I stopped Googling my name about 5 years ago.
I hear you. Well, in that article, they talk about the fact that that you are aggressive in your targeting of either corporate interests or big celebrities. And so we've talked about what you think government can do. Now let's talk about the fact that if you hit people in their wallets, maybe that's how you affect change. You've gone after, I've read, Kmart, Kanye West, others. But does it work? And how collective a voice do you need to make an impact?
Yeah, look, great question. We believe that if corporations aren't going to exercise corporate social responsibility, if they don't see the importance of acting ethically, then we have to force them to. And often the only thing they understand is money. So if we lead boycotts against them, then sometimes they're forced to change. And we have seen corporates being forced to change, big name corporations that have been forced to change. But, you know, I don't want to be reactionary all the time. I would like to see corporates saying, well, actually, you know, we do want to do the right thing. We recognize there's a mutual benefit to us and to society. And so we've launched something called the Corporate Social Responsibility Pledge here, inviting corporates to sign a pledge not to objectify women and sexualize girls in their products, services, and marketing, you know, similar to the fair trade movement, the movement for fair chocolate, the fair wear movement, which have all taken off around the world. Why can't we bring corporates to the table and say, look, there's a benefit to you in this? We're asked to recommend corporates all the time where people can shop ethically and not have to worry. So we're trying to appeal to their better natures, you know, where we can. Look, celebrities, we'll continue to target them. We've just had campaigns here in Australia against three of your imports. Snoop Dogg, Tyler, the Creator, and Eminem have all just toured Australia. Tyler, the Creator, is a rap artist who sings vile misogynist songs, and he targeted one of our young campaigners and threatened her online, stirred up his fan base into a frenzy of violence against her, and she actually filmed him doing that at his concert, put that on YouTube. He didn't know she was there as he was abusing her, and that as a result meant that New Zealand actually wouldn't allow Tyler the Creator into the country 3 weeks ago as a result of viewing that footage. So look, these guys are harder to take on in a way because they're so powerful. You know, that doesn't mean, again, that we just give up. We need to expose misogyny, violence against women in all its forms. In Australia, we made the point, what is the use of having a national plan to address violence against women when you roll out the red carpet to celebrities like this who come over here and promote it and sing about it and glamorize it in their violent, women-hating lyrics?
Well, and you touch on such an important point, I think, when it comes to the fact that this can be good business sense. It's not just a good idea for society, that it can actually be good for business. I spoke to this is sort of a strange parallel, but this is what it made me think of. I spoke to an auto dealer in our area who is consistently recognized as being one of the most ethical businessmen when it comes to treatment of women and all customers. And oddly enough, I guess it shouldn't be a surprise, that there is a reputation among car dealers and auto body shops to try to take advantage of women with the idea that, you know, women will know less than men, which, by the way, in my household, my wife knows a lot more than I do about it. But, you know, so he and I were talking about the fact that he's recognized as being ethical. And some of his competitors have sort of privately told him, oh, you're just exploiting this attitude. And he said, no, I'm doing the right thing. And if it happens to earn me attention that helps my business, why should I be embarrassed about that?
Exactly. That's exactly right. And what's happening is that globally, parents and other concerned citizens are boycotting major corporations who aren't doing the right thing. And that's why there's a, you know, a lot of popularity with online stores such as Toward the Stars, which was started by an Australian woman. And that's a business, online business, which sells products and services for girls which don't sexualize them, which don't objectify them, which don't gender stereotype them. We now have, as I said, the Brave Girls Want campaign, which is just spread around the world in rapid time, because people are looking for alternatives. They're fed up. They're really sick of what's going on. And as you say, the corporates that do the right thing, they'll find that there is a benefit, that there's a reward there. But as long as they keep doing the wrong thing, there won't be. I mean, we've just seen this example with Target. I'm not sure if you've seen that, with this grotesque photo shopping.
I did see it, yep.
Yes, where they've, you know, created a false, what we call thigh gap or box gap, in a young junior model. They've basically, you know, cut away part of her genitalia to achieve this effect. It's grotesque, and you know, I hope they pay a really, really big price for that.
If you don't know what Melinda's talking about, apparently the message or the mission for the creator of that image for Target was that you need women in visual media need to have a certain distance between their thighs because, you know, it must be visually appealing. And so they photoshopped the heck out of it and ended up looking ridiculous. I can't even believe that it passed an editor. Could you, Melinda?
No, it was extraordinary. It was so badly done. There was no subtlety to it at all. You know, it looked like they just hacked away this woman's lower half. It just looked absolutely ridiculous. But the problem is that so many girls want to have a thigh gap. So many girls hate themselves if they don't. So many girls judge each other at school, you know, every day on things like that, their physical appearance. So there are demonstrable harms from these kinds of images, and it's not just the one image in isolation, it's the cumulative total effect of all of these images that our young people are bombarded with every day, which causes them to hate themselves, to be disgusted by their bodies, to think, you know, that they're fat and ugly and freakish, you know, when they're not at all. And so Target needs to be shamed for contributing to that raft of negative physical and mental health problems in our girls especially.
I guess I'm maybe an optimist on this issue in that I feel like 5 years ago we didn't see very much lampooning or calling out of the companies that use this kind of imagery, and now we see it with some regularity. When the photoshopping is grotesque, we are starting to see a rising voice, and in the United States, we've even seen demonstrations with young girls who are 15, 16, 17 calling on magazines to change. Does that give you hope?
Look, it does, and it's the one thing that keeps me going, to be honest, and you are right. It's happened only in the last 5 years or less. 5 years ago, even the term sexualization did not have a lot of currency in the culture. Now it's an everyday term. Now you can pick up any newspaper, turn on any TV station, and you'll hear the word. And so I think that's a great advance. You mentioned the younger women in America. You know, I think you're referring to their action against 17 magazine, I think it was. And calling for change, exposing airbrushing and photoshopping and digital enhancement, saying, you know, we want something better. And I believe that the change will come from the younger women. It's my generation that has inflicted this poisonous, toxic culture on young girls. I believe it's them that will lead the global movements for change. And that is what I tell girls all the time. I speak to thousands of girls in schools a year and help them to see the power that they have, you know, especially when they're coming up to voting age. The politicians will listen to them. The corporates want their loyalty. They want their brand loyalty. They want it early. So they have a massive, massive power to exercise influence and to raise their voice, and that's happening globally, which, yes, I agree, does give me hope.
I want to wrap our conversation with Melinda Tancred-Reist, a journalist, author, and social commentator who's going to be part of the Feminists for Nonviolent Choices series on sexualization of young girls with, unfortunately, the snow yesterday wiped out the plans to show the Sexy Baby documentary at the Little Theater, but they're going to be doing that in April. This is a documentary, Sexy Baby, that focuses exactly on the issues we've been talking about. And one of the themes of this film, Melinda, is that kids feel like, the young girls in the film say, they feel like pioneers in a new age because pornography is available instantly and on many different mobile devices. Our world is not going to go back. Parents to a lot of the kids today cannot necessarily perfectly relate to that. And kids are probably always going to be able to access sexual imagery if they look for it. What do you think this generation is learning about that? And what are the challenges for a generation that doesn't have an older adult generation that can easily or fully relate to that?
Yeah, I mean, that's just a fantastic question. And you mentioned that, you know, kids can always look for it. I tell you what, it finds them whether they're looking for it or not. To give you two examples, pornographers have created entire pornographic websites based on children's most popular cartoon characters. Dorothy the Dinosaur, Dora the Explorer, Atomic Betty, The Simpsons all have hardcore XXX porn sites named after them. So a child can be just doing an innocent search for a cartoon character and they can stumble upon a XXX site. Another thing pornographers have done is that they have studied the most common keystroke errors children make when they type search terms into search engines, and they send them to porn sites based on those errors. The child wasn't looking for porn. The child made a mistake and was sent to a porn site. So the child doesn't have to be looking. Now, what we need to do is adults need to exercise some authority here and some regulation. You know, of course we can't control everything. We can have every internet filter on at home, but they might still see it on an iPhone at school. They might still see it at a friend's house. So we need to have conversations. We need to keep the channels of conversation open with our children, not make them feel ashamed if they have seen something, because they will see something. But again, it takes a village to raise a child. And this is where we need our governments, our regulatory bodies, to step up. You know, we don't allow sewage just to run down the street, but we are allowing this open sewer of the internet to flow into our homes, to flow into our children's lives, shaping and conditioning their sexuality in ways, you know, never before seen. And what hope do our children have of forming healthy sexual partnerships, relationships in the future when this is the formative environment in which they're growing up in? So we need to take action. Adults need to get their heads out of the sand. You know, a lot of parents have no idea of what the kids are seeing. They think they're seeing images of naked breasts. You know, they don't always understand. They're seeing torture, sadism, violence, incest porn, rape porn, bestiality. You know, so we need to wake up and agree collectively to take action. It's too hard for individual parents on their own. This needs to be a collective effort across every level of the culture.
That's Melinda Tankard-Reist, who is an Australian journalist, author, and social commentator, who on Tuesday will be helping lead a book discussion at Writers and Books. She's participating via Skype, and her books are Getting Real, Challenging the Sexualization of Girls, and Big Porn, Inc., Exposing the Harms of the Global Pornography Industry. Feminists for Nonviolent Choices is a local organization that is bringing her work here as part of their series of events. Coming up, they've got events today. They've got college engagements. They're out talking to students today. There is a luncheon and community call to action tomorrow. There is an art gallery and an exhibition on Saturday from 5 to 9 at the Brainery at Village Gate, which, if you've never been to the Brainery, it's a pretty cool place. And then again, Melinda Tankard-Reist's book discussion Sunday from 2 to 4 at Writers and Books. So they've got a very busy schedule, and you can check them out online, Feminists for Nonviolent Choices. Another person they've been working with is the woman who is with Verily Magazine, the cultural editor of Verily Magazine. We're going to take a quick break and come back, and we're going to talk to somebody who can give us an up-close look at magazine's decisions on how they present women and the impact that could have. That is next on this Thursday, and we'll hear from you as well on Connections. You're listening to member-supported public radio. right, welcome back. Very busy hour here, and want to get right to not only your calls, but to our chance to talk to Mary Rose Somariba. And Mary Rose is the cultural editor for Verily Magazine. That's a new women's fashion and lifestyle magazine based in New York. And Mary Rose is on the phone with us. Good afternoon, Mary Rose.
Hi, thanks for having me.
She was honored, by the way, in 2009 with the Susan B. Anthony List Young Leader Award. And we tried to get you to Rochester for the events with Feminists for Nonviolent Choices. Weather has not cooperated very much this week with anything, Mary Rose. We apologize.
No, that's fine. I look forward to coming back on August, hopefully on April 2nd for the Other Springers. Sexy Baby.
Yeah, exactly. Sexy Baby, the documentary about this issue, will show April 2nd at 6:15 at the Little, and then there will be a discussion. They're hoping to have Mary Rose there for that. Now, you're with Verily Magazine. It's a new women's fashion and lifestyle magazine, and like so many magazines out there, Mary Rose, there must be pressure for how you present women. What have you and the magazine decided when it comes to those standards?
Well, when it comes to those standards, it's been great. The leadership of our founders, Kara Eschbach and Janet Baum, they've dedicated from the start and we've been committed to it, to not using Photoshop on women's bodies, to not printing objectifying content of women. Basically, all the style and fashion content is reflecting and enhancing women's dignity and not compromising it. And it's a really great value that they put up there at the forefront, and we haven't had any problem at all in our experience. We've found a lot of photographers and models, real women models and also professional models, who have been very so thrilled with this new initiative and haven't found much difficulty working and finding people to work with.
263-WXXI, 263-9994 if you want to weigh in or want to chat with Mary Rose Somariba, the cultural editor of Verily Magazine. Now, Mary Rose, there are going to be people who say, hey, a little bit of, you know, how would you describe it? I mean, sexiness or class with certain fashions is part of the culture. It's not always about objectification, and these are obviously subjective issues. How do you decide where the line goes?
I think that's where we have a great people at the helm here, with Janet Baum being our style editor and always curating the best quality content for her, for the fashion side of the magazine. I think, you know, how do you determine something's objectifying? That's a question. One person who's answered it is Caroline Heldman, who did a TED Talk on what she calls the sexy lie. The idea that being a sexual object is empowering. It's just one thing that we don't buy into. We think that, being an object at all is to say that you're an object of certain other sexual pleasure. And instead, we'd like to show women as subjects, as women who are empowered to act and thrive in the world and not be acted upon.
Talking about the sexualization of children, young girls, and a lot of folks want to weigh in on this Thursday afternoon. Barbara in Brighton is on the line. Go ahead, Barbara.
Hi there. I'm delighted to hear about this kind of program because, of course, whether you're pro-choice or anti-choice, everybody agrees with what these two women are talking about. The sexualization of young children has been going on forever, and the sex trade and all of that stuff, it's just horrendous. However, I just wanted to make sure that people understood that there were other groups about that are based in pro-choice feminist groups that are also working on this. And I also just wanted people to remember that the anti-choice groups that have used Susan B. Anthony's name have nothing to do with the local Susan B. Anthony house. So I just wanted to make that clear. But I certainly support all that they're doing to protect our young children and particularly young girls.
Well, Barbara, thanks. I appreciate that sentiment, and I'd like Mary Rose to weigh in. I opened the conversation with Melinda Tankard-Reist, asking her if, how often she deals with the fact that, as an international feminist, I think it's fair to say, that people say you can't be a feminist if you don't, if you're against abortion. And, you know, Mary Rose, what do you think about that debate?
I mean, I do agree with Melinda that it's important to see where we have common ground and really focus on not dividing, but seeing where we can share in our advancements for women, you know. But I think also, you know, I think even those who are, who do call themselves, you know, pro-choice and focus on that issue of abortion and making it accessible to women, I think there is room for a greater look if we really are talking about what women want and what is helping women's freedom of choice, then we need to also seriously take in consideration those things that may be forcing women to make unwanted choices. And I don't think that's maybe as looked into as deeply by the people in the pro-choice side. I think that there's always a fear that any kind of questioning of that will lead to less access of abortion. But I do think that coerced abortion, whether it's by boyfriends or parents or just societal pressures, oh, I don't want to lose my job, I think that would be a serious, serious problem if it ever happened, and we know that it does.
What do you think, Barbara?
Well, you know, we'd need years to discuss this, but the fact of the matter is I find it ironic for anyone who is representing the anti-choice position to talk about how there isn't enough choice on the choice side. But, you know, nonetheless, I'm trying to focus on the things we do have in common, because I think that's a breakthrough on their part, which is the sexualization of young women. And that is horrendous, and it's long happening. And, you know, I think that is a great idea that women from both sides of the abortion debate can work on that, because that everybody agrees with, or everybody who's has any sense. And and actually, of course, I think you can be feminist. I think you know, no matter what you believe. However, part, you know, the core of feminism mm-hmm. has to do with self-empowerment and ability to move through the world in whatever way you want. And of course, that's part of why, as a lifetime feminist myself, I find myself on the pro-choice side of the argument. But like I said, I think the fact that both sides of that argument, which, you know, will be argued forever, can focus on this new approach to an age-old problem, which is the, you know, sexualization of women.
Yeah.
Objectification. I agree with you, Barbara. I really am glad that you do share that. And also, I want to let you know that Feminists for Nonviolent Choice has just notified me they would like to extend the invitation to you to this luncheon tomorrow, Friday at noon at the Susan B. Anthony House in Rochester. And look forward to hearing back from you.
Well, and Barbara, thank you. Her sentiment, I know, is not new, Mary Rose. In fact, Benjamin, who's following us on Twitter right now, is concerned about this very issue, that it is potentially disqualifying in some people's minds when it comes to the discussion of feminism and women's issues. And we could probably spend, as Barbara suggests, years on that. But I'm sure you run into it as well. And for our listeners, Feminists for Nonviolent Choices are a self-described pro-life group, just as Melinda Tankard-Reist is. And Mary Rose, you probably run into it just about everywhere, don't we?
Mm-hmm. That's right. And yeah, I am personally pro-life myself, but I do collaborate with a lot of women in my anti-porn writing and research.
Yep.
And, you know, there's just so many people we can agree with that I think it's important to focus on that.
We're talking to Mary Rose Somariba, who is the cultural editor of Verily Magazine. It's a new women's fashion and lifestyle magazine based in New York. They have taken a position that says we're not going to Photoshop or airbrush our models. We're going to try to present realistic presentations of women in an effort to try not to contribute to unrealistic body image and other issues out there. And we can also tell you Mary Rose has written about an issue that Barbara started to talk about, which is sexual trafficking. I'm going to get to that in a minute, but first I want to get another call in. Amy's on the line. Go ahead, Amy.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm so pleased to have you on the show. That's a great show today. And I can't wait to find out about how I can subscribe to this magazine. It sounds wonderful. But I was interested in Mary Rose's comments, maybe, on your conversation earlier, Evan, with, can't remember the other lady's name.
Yeah, Melinda Tankard-Reist, yep.
Yes, thank you. And she said something like free speech protects perpetrators often. And I think that is a problem that we have in this country, where free speech is seen as protecting perpetrators of violent crimes, perpetrators of this sexualization really of young women. And I think that that whole idea of privacy and free choice often also protects perpetrators. When girls and women find themselves coerced into abortions by people that are perpetrating violence against them in order to protect their identities, when you think about incest and rape victims or even domestic violence situations, where that whole idea of privacy is really to protect perpetrators instead of protecting women. I think it's hurting the women. And I just wanted to hear some comments on that.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Amy. And I'll take Mary Rose's view on this in just a second. For our listeners who are just joining us, earlier in the hour we heard from Australian author, journalist, and a social commentator and an activist named Melinda Tankard-Reese. She's going to be participating on this coming Sunday from 2 to 4 at Writers and Books, talking about her books about the sexualization of young girls as part of this series of events that Feminists for Nonviolent Choices has put together in Rochester. And she made the point, Mary Rose, that often a defense for porn or even the use of pornographic writing and images in multimedia is free speech. And she thinks that she's not comfortable, and I don't want to speak too much for her because I don't want to misrepresent what she's saying, but she's essentially saying the government can and should do more. What do you think?
I mean, I agree that definitely the word freedom is often used by perpetrators of who are encouraging lack of freedom, such as sexual slavery and trafficking and that happens within the porn industry even, or just simply coercive actions, sexual assault within the industry, and it's all under the umbrella considered by the popular public, well, this, no, pornography is free speech. And similarly, this talk of freedom is also in the case when it comes to abortion, as Emily, I think, said, our caller is just...
Amy, we just said Amy.
Oh, Amy. Yes, and I think that, yeah, it's true. I mean, we have to ask ourselves, if people are sexualizing women and abusing girls and women, what happens when there are sexual assaults that are... What happens when there is rape? What happens when babies can be born? And then if that violent abuser doesn't want that baby to be born, there can be forced abortions, and that's a problem. So it can be abused, and we have to just... I think that we need to be honest about those things. And I think we do need to look more closely at the sex industry and acknowledge once we do, we realize there isn't as much freedom in there. A lot of women in the sex industry want to get out. I think a recent study over 9 countries revealed 89% of those who are in quote-unquote sex work, those women who are prostitutes and they would like to get out now. And that's important. If they want to get out now, we should certainly give them the freedom to do so and not make them feel boxed in.
Yeah, Mary Rose, you've written about sex trafficking, and, I think a lot of parents and a lot of people in our society, when we think about the sexualization of our culture, of young girls, we think about magazine images and we think about pornography on television, but we don't always think about sex trafficking. Why have you decided to focus on that?
I just thought it needs more of a close look. And I think it is, the worst possible thing, manifestation of this problem, and it does trickle into the sexual images. So it does trickle into pornography, and it trickles into the media images we see as Super Bowl ads. So all of this is intertwined, but I think that, and they all feed off of one another. And definitely the sexual images on our TVs or in our music videos that kids watch are fueling the attractiveness of pornography, and then that fuels the attractiveness of the sex industry at large and prostitution. So they definitely are sort of like the PR underlying this problem. Side of the sex industry, and I think that's what really, I thought maybe it's the root of the problem. I thought I'd look more deeply into, but yeah, as this caller Amy asked for, how do I get more involved in women's media that is less objectifying, is not perpetuating this image of women as sexual objects? That, stuff by Verily Magazine, it's Verily Mag berylynagh.com, berylynagh.com. We've published a few issues in print, which is really exciting, and they're really gorgeous, and they're on sale on the website. And in addition, we're just, it's a startup magazine, so you know the challenges of that, and we're always looking for support. And so if you like us, please join our Facebook page, you know, join our newsletter, reach out. We're all accessible on the site.
Well, and I know a lot of people will appreciate the standards with which you and the magazine have decided to carry forward, Mary Rose. I appreciate that. And once again, for our listeners, April 2nd at 6:15 at the Little Theater, there's going to be a screening of the documentary Sexy Baby. And they're hoping that they can get Mary Rose here to participate in a discussion after that. I want to bring in an artist in just a second here. So, Mary Rose, I will say thanks for your time today, and perhaps we'll see you in Rochester soon.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
All right. Thanks very much. That's Mary Rose Somariba, the culture editor from Verily Magazine. Now let's, in the last few minutes of this hour, we're talking about a series of events that Feminists for Nonviolent Choices have starting today and running over the next several days. And there is an event on Saturday from 5 to 9. There's an art gallery and exhibition on Saturday at the Brainery at the Village Gate. And Lydia Billings, who is the creator of Trigger Warning, is going to be participating. She's on with us now. Good afternoon, Lydia.
Hey, Evan. How's it going?
Good. Very good. Well, for our listeners who don't know what Trigger Warning is, give us a sketch of what you're going to be doing.
Okay. Well, Trigger Warning is a photography project that I created a few years ago after the rape of a dear friend of mine. And immediately after her rape, I was really struggling with my own emotions and my own struggle to understand what had happened and why it had happened and how something so horrible could happen to anyone. And so as a photographer, I began making photographs to try to deal with my own understanding of what happened. And in the last few years, it's grown and shifted and changed, and I've had beautiful opportunities to photograph survivors of rape who are ready to share their stories and their strength and courage, and that's what Trigger Warning is.
And that's an important subject on any day. Why do you think it fits in with the theme over the next several days with that Feminists for Nonviolent Choices have? They've been talking about trying to protect children, girls, the sexualization of girls, and the impacts that can have on society. Why do you think your work with Trigger Warning fits into that?
Well, it's just you know, it fits right into the direct correlation between sexual violence and sexualization within our culture. When we teach young boys and girls only to value themselves for their outward appearance and for what their bodies look like, that ends up leading to a lot of sexual crime and sexual violence because we haven't taught them how to value themselves as whole, complex, individual humans. And so that's why I think it fits in perfectly. And Trigger Warning aims to showcase just that, complex, whole humans who have survived and who are not simply victimized. People are not objects to be acted upon. We are all complex and whole and individual.
Tell me about the genesis of the name Trigger Warning.
Okay. Well, as you may know, trigger warning is a phrase that is often used on the internet and in different publications as just that. It's a warning for viewers and readers that potentially what they're about to read or the content they're about to look at might be troublesome or, cause them an intense reaction. And as I was searching for a name to title my work the last few years, I kept seeing it and reading it, and, you know, it pops up all over the place, and it's become somewhat controversial because some people think it's used too much and some people think it's not used enough. And I just decided that it was kind of a simple, poetic, and powerful way to title the work that I've created.
We're talking with Lydia Billings, who's the creator of Trigger Warning. That's a multimedia photographic arts movement, and it is going to help serve as a discussion point from 5 to 9 at the Brainery at Village Gate in an exhibition there that Feminists for Nonviolent Choices have. Let me wrap up our discussion, Lydia, with this. We've talked a lot this hour about this issue about the sexualization of young girls, and any parent of a boy or a girl knows the challenge. What gives you hope?
What gives me hope is when I meet people of all ages, including children, who are celebrating in so much more than what, you know, than this objectification, and celebrating in who they truly are and their true value, and what they can bring to the world and contribute to society in a positive way. You know, so many of the people that I've photographed and met and had conversations with have been through traumatic, intense violence, and they've come out on the other side with this incredible hope. And, you know, their strength gives me hope, and every conversation I have that's uplifting and positive just fuels my artwork and creativity that much further.
Lydia, thanks for taking the time to join us on Connections this afternoon.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Lydia Billings, and you can see her on Saturday, 5 to 9 at the Brainerd at Village Gate. It's a busy several days for Feminists for Nonviolent Choices. They had to cancel last night's showing at the Little Theater of Sexy Baby, a documentary about the sexualization of young girls, but that's been rescheduled for April 2nd at 6:15. And there is the gallery exhibit again, 5 to 9 on Saturday at Village Gate, the book talk with Melinda Tankard-Reist Sunday, 2 to 4 at Writers and Books. She's joining from Australia via Skype. And there's a luncheon and a community call to action on Friday. We've had some of our listeners online ask for a full slate of event and writing. You can find it on ffnvc.org. It's all there. Been a very busy 2 hours, and I want to thank all of our guests who took the time to join us today from abroad and from right here in the Rochester area. I'm Evan Dawson. Thank you for joining us on member-supported public radio. Thanks to Dave Campo, our engineer. And tomorrow, we're talking education. I'll be right back here on a Monday. See you then.